Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a pleasure to have you with us on Iran Radio, here in the capital, Tehran. Here's what's just around the corner in the next hours. Our next segment offers a moment of reflection and wisdom. Join us for Hadith of the Day, hosted by Sheikh Muhammad Jafar Danish. This program presents a hadith from the Holy Prophet and members of his household, Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them all, every day along with a brief explanation and commentary on the hadith. In this program, hadith relating to a particular lunar calendar date or solar calendar date are presented. Then it's time to explore how to achieve a fulfilling life with A to Z of life. Sister Zainab James will present an Islamic Iranian lifestyle making use of the ayahs of the Holy Quran, hadith, as well as inspirational poetry, parables, and stories. Then it's time for the spotlight on the day's significant events. This daily program features a roundtable analysis and discussion of topical and controversial issues. Two expert guests provide insightful analysis. Don't miss it. Then it's time for Islamic Laws, hosted by Hujjatul Islam Sheikh Javed Akbari. This program focuses on Islamic jurisprudential rulings based on the fatwas of prominent scholars or maraji. Each episode addresses practical religious questions and explores common issues that arise in daily life. Next on deck, we have Hadith of the Day. Stay with us.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the Day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no
You are listening to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, dear brothers and sisters, dear listeners, dear friends, salam and welcome to this episode of the Hadith of the Day. Today's hadith from the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, touches on a very subtle but powerful aspect of faith. He said, "The believer eats according to the desire of his family, while the hypocrite makes his family eat according to his own desire." At first glance, this seems to be only about food, but in reality it reflects an entire way of living. A true believer, the Prophet tells us, is someone who is considerate, even in simple daily matters like meals. He thinks about others first. So if his children want something, if his spouse has a preference, he adapts. He doesn't impose. His happiness is tied to their happiness. But the hypocrite, on the other hand, is the opposite. He forces his family to bend to his own likes and dislikes. He becomes the center, and everyone else is expected to adjust. Such a person may pray, may fast, may appear religious, but in his home, his selfishness reveals his true nature. I remember this sentence that I really like that. Your true character shows up when you are dealing with the one who cannot defend himself in front of you, who cannot protect or who cannot oppose you your true character shows up there. Modern psychology confirms what the Prophet taught us centuries ago. Research shows that the healthiest families are those where empathy and flexibility are present. Small acts of respect, like listening to what your child wants to eat or say, or letting your spouse choose the restaurant, they strengthen bonds and build trust. When family members feel heard and valued, that's the time they thrive emotionally. On the other hand, families ruled by one person's ego often suffer silently. Children grow resentful, spouses feel neglected, and over time, love turns into distance. Think about it. The table where we eat together is more than just a place for food. It's a symbol of how we live together. If the father or the mother or anyone in charge says, no, it must always be my way, then the table becomes a place of control, not love. So the next time you sit down for a meal, remember this teaching of the Prophet. Ask yourself, am I eating according to my family's desire, or am I forcing them to eat according to mine? This is just an example, a symbol of how we treat each other, how we treat our families. True faith is not just about big rituals. It shows up in the little choices, the daily courtesies, the quiet sacrifices. A believer makes life easier, softer, and sweeter for those around him. Inshallah, you would be like that. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
You just listened to the program Hadith of the Day on Iran Radio with Sheikh Danish.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali.
Searching for the light, and you see no hope in sight. Be sure and have no doubt, He is always close to you. He's the one who knows you best, He knows what's in your heart. You'll find your peace at last if you just have faith in Him. You're always in my heart and mind, Your name is mentioned every day. I follow you no matter what, my biggest wish is
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, lofty levels of humanity. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z here on I'm Being Shred with me, Sister Zainab. And obviously, so lofty levels of humanity. So this, in a sense, is sort of goal setting. We know as Muslims that we can really aspire to, and we can reach very high levels of humanity if we purify ourselves, if we have good akhlaq, if we are pious. And at the same time, we are also taught that if we just become, let's say, ruled by our base instincts, we'll actually sink below the level of the animals. So obviously the high level, the highest levels of humanity that we can attain to actually go beyond, above the angels. And then obviously the very low levels below the animals. So what can we do? Who are these people who achieve these lofty levels of humanity? So for sure, we know that obviously all our infallibles are at the highest levels. The prophets are at the highest levels. Now we know that our martyrs achieve very high levels. But we also have amongst us many people who are purifying themselves, who are very good-hearted and who can also achieve very high levels. So I just want to comment on, for example, one of the martyrs from Holy Defense, Ibrahim Hadi, especially as I've said that this is something that, you know, we can always look to the martyrs to see what did they do? What was so special that made them scale these heights of humanity, basically? So people would say, so friends of Ibrahim Hadi, for example, would say that they'd never seen anyone like him. But what they also then added, some of his friends said that Ibrahim Hadi had grown up in an area that had produced other people like Ibrahim Hadi. Welcome back to A to Z here on I'm Being Shred with me, Sister Zainab. And obviously I'm talking about these lofty levels of humanity that martyrs can achieve and that everyone else, all of us, can also aspire to achieving. And I've just mentioned that some people commented, for example, on Ibrahim Hadi, one of the martyrs of the Holy Defense, and this would, we'd be able to say similar things about all the other martyrs. So he, for example, had grown up in an area that produced other people like him. People in that area were concerned with halal and haram. People in that area where he grew up as a child, they were concerned about respect and knowledge. Many of them, so many of these youth also played in the local sports teams there, and many of them got martyred. So who were these people? What was this area? And indeed, what were these times? And as we're talking about times, we're talking about the sort of a time of the Holy Defense. What about now? Can we have this same thing now in our local area? So think about it for yourself. Are people in your area, would you say that people are thinking about halal and haram? Are people aware of this? Is this a really important topic? Being respectful, being knowledgeable, so being able to have conversations about this, being very engaged in the community, contributing, participating, helping the local community, and then to such an extent that, for example, if another war were to happen, is everyone in the same space? Is everyone ready to basically be martyred for Islam, for their country, for the Islamic Revolution, and obviously for Islam, whatever country you're in? So this is something. So, and if we answer to ourselves, well, no, I'm not living in an area like that. Or if you say, no one I know is like that. My friends aren't like that. We don't even talk about things like that. Well, you know, if you're aware of that, you have knowledge, so you be them the person that starts with, to start talking about these things. And bit by bit, maybe you can sort of draw other people into that conversation. And if you're aware that these sorts of things are happening, people are really involved in local community, and you're not yourself, then go out there, sort of go to the Majlis, go to the Rosa, involve yourself in your community and keep talking to people. It's really important to sort of also just nurture the community spirit, especially nowadays. So pray that this is just a reminder for all of us. And that was it for today. And I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of AZ here on Iron Beach Radio. And farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
IRIB English Radio.
Us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. For years, they lecture the world on the rules-based international order, on property rights, on legal sovereignty, on the sanctity of law. Now, in a move of hypocrisy, the European Union, under the heavy hand of Washington, has simply stolen what is not theirs, $246 billion. Russian sovereign assets seized frozen under a fabricated, quote, emergency. They dress this theft in the language of morality, of supporting Ukraine, but do not be fooled. This is an act of economic warfare, a desperate escalation by a failing bloc tearing up its own legal scriptures to serve a master across the Atlantic. It has shattered European unity with its own members crying rape of law, and it has been promised with a fierce and justified retaliation from Moscow. In this Spotlight episode, we cut through the Western propaganda. We ask who truly ordered this, how deep are the cracks in Brussels, and is this the final foolish blow to any chance of peace? But first, let's get more details in this report.
The European Union has indefinitely frozen Russia's assets in Europe over the Ukraine war. Using a special procedure meant for economic emergencies, the bloc's governments agreed to immobilize $246 billion. Worth of Russian sovereign assets until Moscow ends the war and compensates its neighbor for the damage caused in the conflict. It's a key step that will allow EU leaders to work out at a summit next week how to use the tens of billions of euros in Russian central bank assets to underwrite a huge loan to help Ukraine meet its financial and military needs over the next 2 years. The move has caused rifts within the EU. Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán slammed the decision, accusing the European Commission, which prepared the measure, of, quote, systematically raping European law. He said the move means the rule of law in the European Union comes to an end, and Europe's leaders are placing themselves above the rules. Slovakia has also criticized the measure, warning that the use of frozen Russian assets could directly jeopardize efforts to end the Ukraine war. Russia's central bank, meanwhile, said it has filed a lawsuit in Moscow against Euroclear, a Belgian financial group that holds the majority of Russian assets. In a separate statement, the central bank also described wider EU plans to use Russian assets to aid Ukraine as illegal and contrary to international law, arguing that they violated the principles of sovereign immunity of assets. Russian officials have also repeatedly said that tapping the frozen assets would be met with the harshest reaction. The legal battle over frozen funds is taking place as the United States pushes for a ceasefire deal between Moscow and Kyiv. A draft U.S. peace plan released last month envisioned using the frozen funds for the post-war reconstruction of Ukraine. As a result, their use by European leaders for a loan before a peace deal could cause tension with Washington. But European officials say the alternative is for Ukraine to face a financial crunch. Analysts believe the asset freeze reveals that the bloc is willing to bend its own rules when politically convenient, eroding the very legal order it claims to uphold and exposing deep fractures within the bloc.
Well, in this episode, we are joined by Mr. Larry Johnson, a former CIA analyst, joining us from Florida, U.S. And Mr. Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst, joining us from Brussels, Belgium. Well, gentlemen, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us during this episode of Spotlight. And Mr. Doctorow, let's go ahead and start off with you. Let's start off with this whole legitimacy on the so-called economic emergency procedure, as they're calling it. Now, some people are describing it as a not-so-simple legal loophole, while others are calling it outright theft of a sovereign nation's sovereignty. I mean, what side would you lean to? Obviously, what's in front of us of basically this over these hundreds of billions of euros, of dollars, excuse me, being stolen by the EU?
Well, let's take this in two steps. What happened on Friday was step one. That is that Ursula von der Leyen put before the member states of the European Union a proposal to end the six-monthly renewals of sanctions against Russia, which had within it the freezing of assets. That was done as a first measure to prepare the way for collateralization of a large loan, a loan in the amount of 145 billion euros, to be paid out in two annual portions of 45 billion each, and the remainder to be used to pay off a G7 loan to Ukraine that has fallen due. Now, step one, I say, because if the frozen assets could be ordered released as a result of failure at the six-month intervals to find unanimity and to continue the sanctions, then that would vitiate the basis for having these funds held in collateral. To avoid that, in the anticipation that at least one member state, namely Hungary, would at some point veto the extension by 6 months, they put this to a vote, and von der Leyen won. But I say this is only step one, and it's procedural. It was simply to put in place the holding of those assets, and with the purpose of their being removed from the grips of Mr. Trump, and thereby giving leverage to the European Union in the ongoing negotiations over peace, from which it has been sidelined. So I see the principal importance of what happened yesterday, which was approved, and was even approved by Belgium, which has been the most vocal opponent of the whole notion of collateralization for purposes of a loan to Ukraine. It passed because it was dealing with securing a place at the negotiating table for Europe. period. The big issue, and which is completely uncertain how voting will go and procedurally how von der Leyen will handle it, is still ahead. That's when the European Council, which is the second executive body of the European institutions, whereas the European Commission is the executive carrying out the daily activities of acting as a cabinet, the European Council meets on big issues. It meets once a month, and it consists of the 27 heads of state and heads of government of the European Union.
Yes, and Mr. Doctorow, if you don't mind me cutting you off right there, I would like to go ahead and bring in our guest from the U.S., of course, Mr. Johnson. Thank you very much for your patience. Mr. Johnson, let's talk a bit about, I mean, basically they violate the principle of the sovereign asset immunity. Now, what precedent has the West now actually even put into play? I mean, does what stops any other nation at this moment from seizing any European, any American assets in the future under their own declared, quote, emergencies, or would that even be different in the European or the Americans' own eyes as not acceptable because it's them being attacked here?
Well, this has the potential to set off a whole chain reaction. In fact, we started to see it with Russia has now filed a lawsuit against Euroclear. I believe it's in a Russian court, but Russia was prepared, for this step. Russia has the potential to seize a variety of European assets. They've avoided doing so because the Russians, in contrast to the Europeans, are much more committed to trying to uphold international law. But all of this, I think, is taking place in the context of we're witnessing a fundamental shift in the international economic order that was established at the end of World War II. Then the United States has been the de facto leader of that for the last 80 years. But now with the rise of BRICS, with the increased cooperation between Russia and China, we're seeing that that whole system starting to unravel because the ability of the West to use economic financial terms as a bludgeon, as a coercive lever over other states is starting to slip. Recall that it was 10 years ago that Russia and China agreed with the West to impose sanctions on Iran. And now, in the wake of the snapback sanctions, Russia and China both said, nah, we're not doing that anymore. We're going to support Iran. So this, this is a last desperate play by the Europeans, and frankly, in the whole context of the war in Ukraine, it's not going to make one bit of difference.
And Mr. Doctor, I mean, let's move over a bit to these EU rifts, to this hypocrisy being taking place at the moment. Analysts are saying that this reveals that the EU bends its rules when politically convenient. But doesn't this finalize the bloc's transformation from, let's say, a community of law to a mere geopolitical tool for Washington, or has it always been a tool for Washington, in your opinion?
Ahead of the facts, I told you about step one. Step one doesn't violate anything. It's simply enshrines in perpetuity what existed till now on a six-month basis. The Russian assets have not been touched. The Russian assets will not be touched when they meet on the 18th and 19th. These are separate issues, but it's very important to make distinctions here to understand why people are voting the way they are. The second step would happen on the 18th and 19th of December, and that is to invoke the same principle of qualified majority, not at unanimity, to vote on the principle of using these assets to open a loan to Ukraine. That already is the point where the assets are touched. Now, as regards the danger of this, it's not just a question of hollow hypocrisy and saying that the European Union doesn't live up to its standards. There's something much more important going on here, and it could lead to the collapse of the global financial system. My colleague has said correctly that the Russians have put a legal action against the holdings that are in Russia and owned by Euroclear. So it's not just the Russians had deposited one way into Euroclear, but Euroclear also keeps deposits with those countries that it deals with. And the Russians are now saying, much more important than the 18 billion euros in Euroclear assets that the Russians can seize at any time they want. More important than that, the Russians are issuing an announcement to the global community to seize Euroclear assets wherever they are. Now, what does this mean and what is Euroclear? Belgium is a small country and people would think or normally that Euroclear is small also. Wrong. Euroclear has $43 trillion in assets under its care. If that starts to wind out, if there is an attack on its assets, which put its financial well-being in jeopardy, then the whole system unravels and you have a global financial crisis. So what Mrs. Neal speak about the Europeans, let's be very specific. This is an initiative coming from very few people who are usurpers of power, who are essentially dictators. And the dictator number one is Ursula von der Leyen. She is the one who hatched this idea and is pursuing it with a vengeance. So before we pin the blame on the whole of Europe, you have to look at who is actually the agent of this crime.
Well, as you did point out there, Mr. Doctorow, the situation is definitely more deeper than anyone is expecting. We have to look at the financial part. We have to see the history behind this. Mr. Johnson, I mean, I know we've seen a lot of your analysis on other shows and, of course, everything that you do. I would like to get your opinion on the situation, the significance of the timing specifically about this so-called economic emergency procedure. Is it have any relation to the very fast advancements by the Russian forces there on the ground, in your opinion, or does that have nothing to do with it?
No, it absolutely does. And as Gil correctly noted, I mean, this is an act of utter desperation by the Europeans. It just shows how they don't have any other playbook to go to, because the advance of Russia right now is so comprehensive, so sweeping and so fast that there is literally nothing that the Europeans can do. Even if they, quote, were going to mobilize to send troops to Ukraine to fight alongside the Ukrainians, they'd be months trying to get their act together on that front. And Gil correctly notes that this poses the potential to unravel the Western-dominated financial system. Because once you destroy faith in an institution's ability to protect your assets, people start going elsewhere. And ultimately, it is the belief that they're going to follow the law, that they're not going to play personal politics. I mean, for goodness sakes, during World War II, my understanding is even though Western banks held financial assets of Nazi Germany that the West was at war with, they still protected those assets. And now here, and just to give you some measure of the desperation, they're willing to throw all of that aside. And again, it would be one thing if they could say, well, if we take that $300 billion, by God, that's going to stop the Russian advance and it's going to actually force them to retreat. That's not the case.
But with that, Mr. Doctorow, I mean, you were talking a moment about who is at fault here. The funds are meant to, quote, as they mentioned, underwrite a loan to Ukraine. Is Europe essentially making the Ukrainian people indebted for decades? I mean, they're coming over money that isn't even theirs to give. How is this going to affect the Ukrainians?
You know, the wording of this loan does not envisage the kind of threat to Ukrainians' interest that you are raising now. It states that the loan falls due at the moment that the Russians pay for the damage they've caused. And the Russians will never pay for the damage they've caused because they're the winners of this war. So this is why it is a transparent confiscation of assets. But the Ukrainians as such will receive the money, will spend the money, will steal the money, and will have no obligation to repay. That is inherent in this deal. Everyone is talking on two sides of their mouth. Mr. De Wever has been extremely brave in risking the wrath of all of the other 26 member countries, 25 member countries, because in Hungary certainly would not be angry about what he's doing. But he has gone up against almost all of his colleagues and said in this declaration that was issued yesterday by four countries, Belgium, Bulgaria, Italy, and Malta. They all said in voting for that waiver of the unanimous voting procedure yesterday, but we can be sure they will not approve application of the same limited majority when it comes up for a vote on applying for a loan against this on the 18th and 19th, Mr. De Vever made firm statements that he supports Ukraine to the end. That's what he says to the European Commission, to look like one of the boys. When he speaks in Belgium, as he did last week, he spoke in French to a gathering in one of the major auditoriums in the center of the city. He said something quite different, that the idea that Ukraine could win this war is a fairy tale and an illusion. He also said to the editor of the major French-speaking newspaper in this town that for Russia to lose this war is not a good idea, considering it's the world's biggest nuclear power, if you follow with the dots lead. So there is a lot of behind-the-scenes maneuvering here, and it's risky to make facile generalizations about what European leadership thinks. But I think the real issue, when Mr. De Vever and his three colleagues said that they oppose the use of the Russian assets for purposes of a loan, they said, oh, we can do something more constructive. We can give a European loan out of our own pockets for that money. He's saying that tongue-in-cheek, knowing that no European country other than Germany is willing to pony up 2 euros to help Ukraine because they'd have to go to their parliaments. That is the real trick here. This, von der Leyen has done, is to count on the violation of democracy across the whole of the EU, not just in parliament, which she oversees, because it means that money will be put up by European governments without going to their parliaments.
Well, exactly, Mr. Doctorow, as you did mention, I'd like to thank you for clarifying those points in our procedure. As we were mentioning, sometimes we've got to make it very clear to the viewers what is actually meant behind the scenes, behind the ink on the paper, if we may. Mr. Johnson, we have around 4 to 5 more minutes. Let me go ahead and get in a few more questions, if we could. Let's just focus a moment on this Russian response/retaliation. They said that it's going to be harsh. Now, they promised this. What kind of form could we perhaps expect other than what they did to there in Russia? Are we looking at symmetrical seizures of remaining Western assets in Russia, or are we perhaps maybe something asymmetrical, economic, maybe a diplomatic warfare? What are you expecting? What kind of reaction from Russia?
Well, Russia is going to follow. They're going to follow legal procedure. They're not going to act recklessly. They're certainly not going to react emotionally. And we saw the first step of it with the legal action, the filing of the suit against Euroclear that was taken, I believe, yesterday. Going forward, if the Europeans actually move ahead and seize assets, the Russians have made provisions to seize European assets that are still in Russia. And what's interesting is, despite now 3, going on almost 4 years of war, and several provocations, continued provocations by the West, particularly by Europe, Russia has not gone after those assets because they still put value in the notion of doing things legally, trying to uphold international law, and trying to ensure that there's some sort of order in the system. It's the West that has continually been walking away from agreements and violating the laws. As you said in your opening, it's almost like, it's the golden rule. Those with the gold get to make the rules. And from the United States standpoint, they said, well, we got all the gold, so we're going to make the rules. And that turns out not to be the case. But, I think Russia's well prepared to retaliate, but they're going to do it unemotionally and legally.
Well, Mr. Doctorow, with the last few minutes, I'd like to go ahead and direct my last question towards you. We have to bring up this draft peace plan being brought up by the U.S. Now, they envisioned it using frozen assets for post-war reconstruction, according to them. By jumping the gun, basically, and using them now for this war funding, has Europe just sabotaged Washington's own peace roadmap, or is everything we see planned? Was there even a peace plan at the beginning?
No, you just identified the logic. It's to sabotage the American peace plan.
And with that, I do have just one more question. If you could each answer it in around 30 to 40 seconds, your own words. Ultimately, how will this actually accelerate the global move away from the dollar, the euro-dominated assets towards alternatives, perhaps among the BRICS nations, around others, who are wary of the Western financial weaponization. For 30 seconds, please, Mr. Johnson, in your own words.
Yeah, well, it's a further reaffirmation that the West is not to be trusted, that the West is a bully, and that they're going to use whatever economic leverage they have over them. So therefore, the Global South, Russia and China, they're moving as quickly as they can to separate themselves from that.
And Mr. Doctor, your answer, please.
The bottom line is the pitch that the advertiser of a talk show both Larry Johnson and I participate in, my goal.
Well, with that, I'd like to thank both of our gentlemen for joining us during this episode of Spotlight. From Florida, USA, Mr. Larry Johnson, a former CIA analyst, and of course, as always, Mr. Gilbert Doctorow, independent international affairs analyst there, joining us from Brussels, Belgium. A pleasure to have you both with us. Well, until next time, goodbye.
She's the love of my life, does everything with a smile. She's my mother, my sweet mother. She can take the pain away with just one look. That's my mother, my sweet mother. You're the picture in the frame with all the colors of the rainbow. I'm far from ashamed to say I love you so. It's late, but I can't sleep tonight. Forgive me if I take my time, but I just have to let you know you're so special. She taught me how to pray. We play games every day with my mother, my sweet mother. Even if I made no sense, listen with patience. That's my mother, my sweet mother. She would sing a sweet song till I shut my eyes and kiss my head and say goodnight. And I feel safe with you by my side. You're there for every step in my life. I'm sorry. You know, you're so precious. If only this was true. I'm in a cold, dark, wet room. I was an orphan, and now I'm 22. I've never known my mom. A picture faded by the sun is all I have. Left alone with nothing more but what I am. It's not enough, this life is tough when there's no one to call my mother, my sweet mother, my sweet mother. If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program,
Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. We're going to actually begin discussing some of the jurisprudential laws related to prayer and whatever actually hovers around the prayer and the questions and concepts related to that. Based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei, let me begin our session with this question regarding ostentation or riya.
Right.
We all know that this is a kind of vice, ethical, you know, let's say a vice or quality that, you know, a few people are somehow engaged with or they are, let's say, suffering from. If a person is afflicted with riya or show off,
yes,
in their worship, and they are now struggling with themselves to overcome this, let's say, vice, is this also counted as a form of riya? I mean, in their worship, doesn't it depend on what kind of worship we are talking about, whether they are recommended or compulsory, for example? How can one keep away from it?
Right. Well, His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei has said that any action done for Allah, including fighting against riya, is not considered riya, because you are fighting, you are trying to uproot riya, to get rid of it.
Yes.
And in order to get rid of it, you do certain activities, you take certain actions. So that's not considered to be riya in legal parlance. To get rid of riya, one must think of the greatness of Almighty Allah, the weakness of his own soul, nafs.
Yes.
And also the weakness of other people's soul and nafs, and their dependence on Allah.
Yes.
And also his subservience to Allah, the Exalted. All of these things, if one realizes and perceives or comprehends the greatness of Allah in his own smallness or in his own insignificance, he will gradually get rid of riya, get rid of ostentation, or get rid of hypocrisy.
I see. Well, another question regarding the prayer or worship is that when attending congregational prayers with the Sunni brothers and sisters, you would hear the word Ameen, which is pronounced immediately after the imam finishes reciting the Fatiha. What's the Shia ruling on this?
Well, if it is required, let's say, by taqiyya, if taqiyya requires you to say Ameen, in the said situation, there is no problem in saying Ameen. But if there is no such a circumstance in which you are required to do taqiyya, of course, it's not permissible to recite Ameen, because it's not part of the prayer. It is a kind of addition to the prayer, which we do not accept. Of course, as Sunni Muslims do say it, but we are not supposed to follow them in their suit and say the same thing.
I see. Yes. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Stay tuned.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/EM. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah. Let me go astray, cause I need you.
Welcome back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are speaking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to worship and prayer, according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, in our obligatory prayers, is it allowed to say some of the words of the Fatiha or of another chapter, let's say, or a dhikr in a loud voice in order to warn a child, for example, who's doing something dangerous or doing something harmful, for example, to himself or herself, or to make the occupants of the house aware of the situation so that they may remove the danger? In addition, what is the status of the person's prayers during which he, through some kinds of gestures of the hand or raising the eyebrows, informs another person of something or a danger or answers his question?
Okay. Well, if the raising of the voice, which reciting a verse or zikr for the purpose of warning others, does not cause an individual to lose the status of being in prayer, then there is no objection to doing so. It is it's permissible, provided that the recitation and the dhikr are done with the intention of recitation and zikr, and not with the intention and recitation to warn other people. Okay, the intention is very important. So if moving the hand or eyebrows or eye is brief and does not ruin the necessary composure and stillness of the prescribed form of the prayer, it would not lead to the invalidation of the prayer. So it's okay if you can do so. If you can raise your voice and alarm someone, you should do so. It's okay.
I see.
Because the composure and the structure of the prayer is not invalidated, it's not destroyed.
Mm-hmm, I see.
But if that's not sufficient, you can recite a word of the hamd and surah and a loud voice, provided that the recitation and zikr are done with the intention of recitation and with the intention of zikr.
I see. Does the passing of hands over the face after the qunut invalidate the prayer? And in case of the prayer being actually rendered as void as a result of this act, is it also considered a sin?
No, it's not considered a sin. You know, it does not invalidate the prayer, because you do nothing. You just pull your hands over your face, or one of your hands over your face. The religious authorities, including His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, have said that it is discouraged, it's makruh to pull your hand over your face after you finish or complete the qunut. This is done by Sunni Muslims, but we are not supposed to do the same thing, okay? It is, according to scholars, abominable, undesirable, and discouraged.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take another break and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Don't go anywhere.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are speaking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to worship and prayer according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, in face of the hustle and bustle of city life and the modern life, actually, today, people find it pretty hard. Everybody actually does that, they find it very hard to find peace and quiet and to stay position your body and your mind in a meditative, let's say, a state.
Right.
Right? And when we are about to offer our prayers we find lots of distractors.
Right.
Is it okay, is it permissible to close our eyes in order to avoid distractions?
Well, there is no Shari'i problem in shutting eyes or closing your eyes during prayer, although it is makruh to do so in other than ruku.
Mm-hmm.
The scholars have said, generally speaking, that it is makruh to close your eyes during prayers. You should use other methods to gain concentration during prayer. And of course, concentration is a big problem, yes. A big challenge. In this, as you rightly said, in this time and age in which people are running here and there in search of, making money or,
making ends meet, yeah.
Yes. So they are actually distracted.
Mm.
So the thing is that the scholars have said that they should detach themselves from their businesses, from their occupation, from the worldly activities and worldly engagements.
Mm.
And for a few minutes, try to focus themselves on their prayers and what they recite. Okay, if they continue to do this, if they continue to practice this for a while, then they will get used to it.
Mm.
But it's necessary. It should be a continuous process to focus. If a person continuously focuses on his prayers and what he recites during prayer, he will get used to it,
mm-hmm.
and he will not get distracted very easily.
You said it's considered actually makruh,
to shut your
reprehensible,
eyes.
Except in sujood or ruku.
Ruku.
Ah, I see. Okay. As the last question, let me ask you this question also to include or squeeze in this episode at the end. Somebody asked us, during my prayers, I sometimes recall a spiritual heights and elevations that I experienced on the days of the confrontation with the infidel Ba'athist army. And this helps me, increase my humility in prayers. Does this or doing so invalidate the prayers?
Well, it does not harm the validity of the prayer because it's not considered to be one of the invalidating agents. Okay, So if one is recalls what he has experienced in the past during any bloody confrontations, whatever. Okay,
yes.
So this just remembering those things and those spiritual heights will not definitely affect the validity of the prayer.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh.